Today is April 13, 2019. It's 1:30 p.m., and our session is called Closing the Technological Divide, Access and Resources. I'm Julia Richmond. I'm the Chief Innovation and Technology Officer for the City of Boulder, and I'm pleased to be joined on this panel with three distinguished guests. Before we get to that, just a little bit of administrivia. In this session, as you probably know if you've attended any other session, we'll utilize both an app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. I will receive those up here in this computer. And if you'd like to use a note card, request that by raising your hand, and one of the producers, if you could raise your hands in the room, will hand that over to you, and then they will give those to me. Please write legibly. Hard to answer a question we can't read. And if you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. Please make your questions brief and to the point. Okay, with that, let me introduce our panelists. I'm joined by Alex Bard, who is a philosopher, author of, I think, 5 books. None of them slim. Former rock star, producer, television star. In preparing for this panel, I experienced Alex on the internet. Everything from tears from prodigy child singers in Sweden's Got Talent to elaborate philosophical discussions with a friend in a podcast that I believe you two produce. So a wide array of interests and experience there. Tulio Cardozo, who is the technical manager for something called The Last Mile, which is a training program for people who are incarcerated to learn technology web development skills. He's the first credentialed employee to work in San Quentin, is that correct?
After living in San Quentin,
not just showing up there. And I think one of the more interesting things about your bio is that you were born in Venezuela to born in India to Venezuelan and Argentinian parents, moved to the U.S. Talk about a global nomad. So a lot of different experiences there. And then Pochi Wu, who is a venture capitalist on faculty at the University of Hong Kong, or Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, and also visiting at UC Berkeley, interested in building structures within ambiguity across the globe. I would say in preparing for this panel, Pochi had a real impact on me in terms of thinking about the impact of learning creativity and connecting global dots. So some different perspectives there. Rather than starting this panel with kind of long-winded comments, feels like Saturday afternoon is the time to shake things up. So we're going to start with kind of a lightning round of defining what the problem is in disruptive technology and access. So I have 3 questions for our panelists, and we can go in order. The first question is, what is the most significant technology divide that you see in society today? What is its impact, and who is impacted? And I can do the questions again if we need to each time. So first question, what is the most significant technology divide? What is its impact, and who is impacted? Go ahead.
Okay. When I started working on my first book in 1998 at the Stockholm School of Economics Digital Studies Department, we went around the world, my colleague John Sedekist and I, and one of the things we wanted to check out was the idea of the digital divide. There were certain people who got access to the online world and some people who didn't. And we came to Andhra Pradesh in India, and we went through the entire province of 120 million people at the time, and we found out that every damn village in the entire state of Andhra Pradesh in India already in 1998 had free available internet. Okay, it didn't mean that everybody was online, but it was available and free to all. So it seems already then that the digital divide is not about whether you have access or not to the internet at all. It wasn't already 20 years ago. Its number one issue is this is electronics. So all electronic platforms, that means electricity is key. And about 2/3 of the people today who still lack permanent electricity in the world are in Africa. So the number one issue here is to get electricity available. Sometimes solar power, wind power, stuff like that can help. But to have permanent electricity available means you need a functioning grid. And even in countries like Nigeria, where we're today, this is the main problem for startups. electricity goes out every day, okay? It doesn't any longer in India. It doesn't any longer in most of the rest of the world. And in most parts of Africa, electricity is increasingly working really well. So if you got electricity and you got 3G, and you got 3G everywhere, you're the best, smartest 3G in the world has been built in India, costs hardly anything, meaning that people get smartphones very, very quickly and easily go online. And we discovered this already a few years later in South Africa. We worked with this cell phone is a weapon campaign, where we went into the slums of Cape Town, Joburg, Durban, the major cities, and discovered that as soon as people in these neighborhoods had, you know, the first priority they did before even running water was to get a smartphone. That's why the campaign was called the smartphone, or the cell phone is a weapon. So we learned people, you'll be political agents, will be active, you can express your own opinions because you got these machines. So that's not the problem to me at all. The problem occurs online. And the problem is that we all go online first in a flat environment, it's a flat landscape. You know, it doesn't cost you anything to open a Gmail account, Facebook account, Twitter account, whatever. So you open these accounts, cost you hardly anything, at least not money. And once you're online, then the problem is that the online world is basically 8 billion people screaming at the top of their lungs all at the same time. It's like a madness of cuckoos, you know. So the way to get around that is that, of course, we start following certain people after a while and not everybody. We can't listen to everybody. We can't like everything. So then we get a class system, and that's what we wrote in the first book. We took a Marxist take on the internet. And I would just define this by saying that if you got 140,000 Twitter followers, or if you got 41 Twitter followers, that's an enormous difference in influence and power. And the problem is if you got 41 Twitter followers today, you're probably likely to have 35 next year. And if you have 140,000 Twitter followers this year, probably 300,000 next year. So this is just, these divides are just exploding right now. So there are a few people out there and a few teams and a few subcultures that get large followings because they do things that either entertain or inform people in a way that people find pleasant, and that's why we follow them. And there is increasingly a mass of about 80% of the population who go online, and they've been fooled by Facebook to become addicted to scrolling and things like that, but not being heard or seen by anybody. So the real divide is happening online, with a small elite of at best 10-15% of the population joining that elite, and a large majority who are just basically looking for somebody who can find them, and they end up in very, very small local pools with very little influence.
Thank you. Great. Tulia?
So I think one of the biggest problems with the technological divide is going to be really summarized between Alexander and myself. And it's access and it's awareness. So I'm a person who hasn't had access to international travel. I'm a person who hasn't had awareness of what's going on in other places, which I'm actually coming up a lot real quick. I want to ask you some follow-ups after this. I'm just a person that is a typical community member of minority, came from a neighborhood where there were other people that were definitely more affluent, but I didn't have those kinds of resources in my household when I grew up. The thing that I think it makes the impact is that by not having access to people in your neighborhood that can teach you about technology, not having access to people in your neighborhood that can show you that there's two buckets, actually, I should define. There's the hardware stuff, which I think is really simple to solve, and then there's the feeling like you should be doing this side of it, which is like the educational side, it's the comfort side, it's the awareness side. And I think that what's happening is in society we have a whole lot of neighborhoods that don't have access to the people that have these experiences, so you feel like you belong as part of this. You feel like you know, take for example, I have an elderly parent. My elderly parent, for the life of me, I've taught her so much about how to use Netflix, but I can't get her to use a computer. I can't get her to use these other tools like FaceTime and Skype, because I'd love to show her my little boy and all those things remotely without having to show up. And the thing is she doesn't have in her network other people that can have the patience to teach her those things. So I think that, you know, as far as that goes, like the technological divide is really, there's those two buckets of the hardware, that's the easy part to solve, and the social access, social network, social capital that helps you to feel like you belong there. Being that I have to speak from what I had access to, mm-hmm. A lot of the work that I've done has revolved around incarceration. It's more recently, it's involved around education in specific. And one of the things that we've noticed is that by by providing technology packets, if you will, for people who are re-entering society, that involved the hardware component, that involved a master plan component that started long before they were released, they were able to access the things that they needed, and basically the community members that they needed. They needed the awareness of these tools that existed, and basically they were able to access a feeling of belonging in a digital society, so that when they returned, they didn't feel like, I shouldn't be here. They didn't feel like, ooh, this is complicated, I should just give up. They actually felt like, this is something I should be a part of, and I need to be a part of. It's my social responsibility to be a part of. So I think that in many ways, while this is not a potentially like a global issue, depending on how you look at the optics of it, I think that it is very much a pertinent issue across lots of the parts of society. It's not just about people who are incarcerated, in my perspective. It's just, it really cuts through many different communities, not just like Boulder, but like the rest of the United States. That's not like California as well, that doesn't have a lot of this information for people who can't afford to be a part of it, or don't have any other people in the community, or their communities in general aren't really participating in the digital economy.
Coachee? Could I ask you to repeat the question?
Yes.
I have a reason why.
Yes. Three questions. What is the most significant technological divide? What does it impact, and who is impacted?
Okay.
What is its impact, and who is impacted?
Right. So when I made some notes for myself, it seems to me the first question is a what question. Mm-hmm. Second question is a why question, or either second or third. And the other is a who question. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all the things that my fellow panelists have talked about are completely accurate, physical resources, economic resources. I want to talk about, yours is kind of the education gap. And what I'm going to talk about is an enlarging on that, which is actually a technological divide within our own brain. And this is because we have been experiencing an accelerating rate of change in technology to the point where most individuals, as well as groups, actually don't know what to do with it. Not just the mechanics of accessing, Skype, but really not understanding what potential impact or how they can benefit from it. So that's sort of random bits of experiences. And unfortunately, there are more than enough not-so-good people who are out there, especially in the Internet, who are just willing to pounce on those relatively naive lambs. So what I'd like to emphasize is this is an education problem, in basically, a general issue for each of us individually, in that we need to learn more. But schools, universities, companies have to have a better focus on, in fact, this idea of what is the impact. We want to create all these new tools. We want to build all these powerful computers and networks. How does that actually translate into impact on society? This is a very big question. You don't hear enough discussion about that.
Great, thank you. An interesting place to start, for sure. Maybe we'll start with a question to Tulio, and then other panelists, please respond as well. In your experience, you work in technology that helps prevent recidivism, create opportunity for folks who are currently incarcerated. I wonder, what is the role of technology in preventing incarceration in the first place and creating opportunity before that point of crisis?
Huge. So I really wish that I wasn't in the business that I am in. First and foremost, yes, things should be solved long before. I think the role of technology, though, in our communities, it's about social empowerment, it's about economic empowerment. And again, access to these tools is just not something that's available in a lot of neighborhoods. I have a former employee who was an inmate, worked for me for the only company in the United States that is allowed to, is set up currently to do business with private companies and pay inmates minimum wage, $16.49 an hour, and they pay taxes and room and board. Please don't get mad at me, I'll explain it all. $16.49 an hour.
Eat it.
Can anybody hear me?
Yeah.
All right. So, I had this employee that got out recently, and one of the very first things that he did is set up his own nonprofit to educate other people that were like him in his own community about how to become something that they weren't aware was an option, and that was a actual hardworking normal American. In his community, you had two jobs, rap or play ball. That was it. And he taught them that, hey, not only can you do that or play ball, you can actually be a software developer, and look at me, I work for a big company, and I'm here to help you do this if you want to do it. And so I think that the role that technology plays in communities like that is really to spark awareness, spark, I guess in my comments, there's like this thread of like belonging. And I think that people need to feel like they belong, but in order to do that, they need to see other people that look like them being involved in this. And then ultimately, the last thing that is really related to that aspect is actually seeing people be successful at it. And I think that that's where technology is, because it's the great equalizer. It doesn't matter where you went to college. It doesn't matter what your background is, both from a criminal perspective like myself or from, you know, like ethnic, gender, any kind of affiliation with religious beliefs, any of that. It doesn't matter at all. What matters is, can you do the job? Can you be judged by the quality of your code? And if you are, then great. It is the great equalizer. So I think that technology is really enabling a lot of people that are taking advantage of it, but it is something that we've noticed that the more we're able to put this back into communities at a year earlier age with programs that are centered and specific for juveniles, because they're at that age where they are making decisions for the rest of their life. And if it's not an option, and this is actually something I spoke about earlier. Somebody summarized it in a way that I'm going to share here. It's kind of a blanket statement, but and I apologize if anybody's offended by it that's younger. But the statement was is that kids take choices and adults make decisions. And when we're younger, we're taking choices based on what is available to us. When we get older, we realize that sometimes you just got to pave your own path forward and figure it out, even though there may not be an option. And so I think that in technology and in communities, with juveniles, they're just looking for what's available as an option. They're not necessarily realizing, like, this is what I want to do, this is where I'm going to go, and I'm going to figure it out some way or another. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I think we need to do a better job at presenting this as a viable option earlier so that people realize that they can do it, they see it as an option, so that when they try it as an option they start doing it more and more every day, and then one day they make a decision to stick to it for the mm-hmm. rest of their life, regardless of whether or not it's technology to be a developer or it's technology just to do some other kind of job, because you can't even take a taxi nowadays without having to pay for it on a digital screen, iPad or something in the back seat. Like, technology is everywhere, so you better get on it.
The trick here is subsidiarity and also understanding that digital is totally different from what we had before. That means most of the stuff we see today in society are not what's going to be digital. We basically see children's diseases right now. I give you a perfect name for that, influencer. An influencer is the idea that you can somehow be some kind of a television star and do your own TV show at a low budget and then have hundreds of thousands of followers. And just because some people manage to get hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram by showing new shoes every day, they think this is the future of the internet. It isn't. Because the one thing Americans have to understand probably more than anybody else is that individualism is dead and over with the internet's arrival. Digital will kill individualism. Digital is all about tribal. And the reason why that is because the phenomenon itself is network dynamical. But you can use that exactly by giving people paper and pen and sit down with them and paint their own sociogram. That means you paint an own map of your own subcultural context. Who are my friends? Where do I belong to? Ethnic belongings, geographical space, where do I live? My age group, my gender. All those things are different categories, social categories. So basically you then map the person and you say, why don't you go and find your team in the thing you love the most, or your profession, something you're passionate about that's meaningful to you, and then you get subsidiarity in return, and that is a very, very human sense of connection with my own network. Then you can look at what other networks is this network overlapping. How do you create connections between these networks? So what we're increasingly going to see over the next 10 years is that we're going to stop following the Kim Kardashians of the world, or otherwise the underclass is going to follow Kim Kardashian, because that's a losing strategy. Instead, we're going to follow people who build teams, who build teams, who build teams, who build subcultures. And yes, some of these sects and cults I'm talking about here are going to be really weird and strange, like Donald Trump or whatever. But, get used to it, because we are looking for these tribal connections online. That's what's going to win eventually. But we can then work with that from a self-confidence perspective. Once somebody got their social map in front of them, these are the people I do know. These are the people who respond to me instantly if I call them, right? That's your social network. Then build from that. Give you a perfect little example that I can use. I work here in North America every year, but I live in Stockholm, Sweden. That means when I send emails to people I met in North America, I always sign my email, your new ambassador to Scandinavia, Alexander. I'm then representing a network called Scandinavia, where I know tons of people who are very influential. I'm a popular person. Most of my 90,000 Twitter followers live in Scandinavia. But then I also teach other people, you can do the same thing. Even where you just live, say Boulder, Colorado, you can be representative of Boulder, Colorado to people you meet from around the world. This is to see the world from a network dynamical perspective. So you see the entire world is connected, and this world consists of subcultures that have different interests. And once these subcultures overlap with each other, you can then be the ambassador and the go-between between these networks, and then you become influential. You can build your entire career based on that from now on. That's digital.
Great. Poochie, anything you would like to add?
I forgot where we started.
We started in, is there a role for technology in preventing incarceration or the point of crisis in the first place?
No, I think we pretty much covered it, but it is really about education, isn't it? And in a much broader sense, not just the technological, like, you know, we wanted to have primary school kids learn how to code. Well, that's fine and that's helpful, but it's much broader than that. The things that Alex is talking about are actually more how we want to function, as you called it, our own social network. What is a community? What's a tribe? What does that even mean to us? You know, who do we want to associate and interact with in a positive way? I mean, we have to focus on that, right? Because there are plenty of the negative stuff. Let's focus on the positive stuff.
Great. We just got a question from the audience, which I think is relevant to the point in the conversation that we're in. The question is, technology has a tendency to favor those companies or people with advantage to the point that smaller companies or competitors have to fold. Big companies eating little companies for breakfast, for example, or people with large social networks having big social pull. On the other hand, technology provides new opportunities for sideliners via almost free, universally available choices and chances. You can start a business quite easily, et cetera. Question is, which scenario is more likely to prevail? How do we move from one scenario to the other?
So let me start with that, because I do teach entrepreneurship. I've been doing that for the last 10 years. About 30 years ago, I started being a venture capitalist and working with small companies. So that this is my playground. And this is a question that comes up constantly, right? Entrepreneurs are always asking, how are we going to compete against the big guys? And this is not a new technology problem. This has been the situation forever. Of course, it's not easy, right? You're saying you're going up against powerful entities. They have powerful networks. They have better technology. They have more resources. And all of that is true. So I like to boil it down, because I teach entrepreneurship, I like to boil it down to a faith, really, in the, and I don't mean necessarily a specific religious faith, a faith in the human spirit, in the human potential. So that's really the way I describe myself. I call myself an investor in human capital. So that's human potential plus intellectual capital. You have to believe that human beings, hopefully, if you take the long view, 100-year cycles, human beings, the solid human values that we all really would like to live by will persist. Now, what that means in terms of the dynamic between different power organizations and power structures simply means it's going to change. And I think with the advancing technology, that volatility is going to increase. We're going to see more big companies fail. We're going to see more new companies come up. We're going to see a lot of new companies fail too. So, you know, startups are not the panacea for everything. But what startups represent is the innovative spirit, the creative spirit that all of us have expressed through business. Now, we have to continue encouraging that. That's another education piece. But we have to believe that that is, in fact, the path. If we believe that established power is so rigid and is simply going to overcome, you can certainly do that. But then that means that your view toward life is pretty hopeless. And I really don't believe that any of us can really live and thrive in a world where we don't have hope.
I agree completely. I would add that a giant company will either have to transform itself into a platform for the next technology, or else it will go down. That means, for example, if you look at Google today, it's a company, what, 60,000 mathematicians, a lot of autistic nerds, okay? They've collected tons of data, but they're not going to exploit the value out of that data on their own, because they've got to be capable of doing that, just like Apple did when the app revolution started. So the next, either you turn your big giant company into a platform for the next generation, and that's how you can survive. Microsoft have managed to do it a couple of times now. And that means the next big wave now in technology is probably going to be deep tech. That's what it's called in France, at least. I don't know about America. Deep tech means that how can we now find value in all the data we've collected? That's going to require a whole new generation of startups, because it's a different talent to try to find data that means something to human beings and then do something with that data that's valuable to them. Collecting the data is one aspect. Then exploring that data and do something valuable with it is a totally different talent. And whenever a new talent is being played out, that's exactly when a new wave of startups come to the forefront. And all they need to do is to find one weak spot the other guys haven't done, and they can tip the whole game. So that's going to happen. Also, a paradigm shifts. Normally, if you're born close to where power is, that benefits you. You have all the benefits in your life. You get the best education. You get ahead of everybody else. And you're probably very likely to inherit the fortune of your fathers and your mothers. That's what usually happens in history. But at paradigm shifts like the current one, those rules change completely. That means if you started a factory, you had to live close to where all the things the factory needed were already located to start that factory. But now when Wi-Fi is universally available, Peter over there and I, we travel a lot. We go to Africa, for example. Now we work with startups in Nairobi, Lagos, and Addis Ababa. And it's amazing what's been done there in only the last 2 or 3 years. Simply because they managed to get fat cables in there, and then they have great Wi-Fi available, and as soon as the electricity was there, the kids would just walk straight into the room, learn programming, and they would start doing startups that worked for Africa. And it's now exploding. So what's great about the current revolution is that the universal availability of Wi-Fi, if we can also make the universal availability of data, then certainly this is a widespread phenomenon, and then everybody will have access to it.
I want to just enlarge on that. You know, the network is one idea, but a better metaphor, of course, is an ecosystem, which is kind of what you've been talking about. Ecosystems are made up of interdependent bodies, interdependent species. I think about like the Great Barrier Reef. And when it's healthy, when the ecosystem is healthy, it allows them to interact. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, there's always, again, the dynamism, some grow, some fail, and so on. But the ecosystem is critical. Without an ecosystem, nobody wins. Mm-hmm.
Leo, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I'm not a VC, and certainly I haven't helped a ton of startups, but I have been involved with some. Certainly I'm not a VC, and I'm not I haven't gone to a lot of places to help a lot of startups, but I have worked with some startups. My co-founders for our organization are venture capital investors as well. And one thing I've learned through watching their investments for the last 7 years is it's kind of what Alexander brought up. If you're not going to be the platform, and you're going to be a company that's trying to figure out what is that, you know, new media or what is that deep information, deep data. You got to find like the one weak spot. It doesn't matter how big a company is, because the bigger the boat, the slower it turns. And I think that the reality is a lot of smaller teams that can find passion, that can find a heart for what they're trying to do, the impact that they're trying to solve, and they can believe in the work that they're trying to effectuate in this world, have the ability to turn a lot faster and really beat a lot of these bigger startups. If it wasn't the truth, then you wouldn't have the whole current slew of big companies that grew up overnight. You know, Slack, multi-billion-dollar whale, grew out of nowhere within a year. It was because they were doing the one thing that all the other guys were not, and they were doing it well and executed well. And it was a really small team. And you know what? Slack, the funny thing about it, I've met the founder of Slack through my work. He's come into the prison to volunteer. He's hired our graduates, and Scott Butterfield, really great guy. But the thing about him that not very many people realize is, like, first couple companies actually didn't work. The reason Slack actually worked was because it was a communication platform for their other company that they were making before for video games. And the video game thing didn't work. But hey, this little thing that we actually needed, that one thing that nobody else was solving, was pretty good. And people like it. And suddenly, $6 billion later, they're going to IPO. And actually, that number's probably bigger. So anyways, that's all I can add.
Great. A question kind of pivoting from here. I'd love to hear your opinions about this sort of chicken and an egg problem of sort of user-centric design. We think about those who have access in our kind of technological Silicon Valley ecosystems, right? It's typically wealthy white men And so wealthy white men are designing systems for other wealthy white men, or the assumptions that they make about people who are not like them making those tools. So how do we get to a place where we've got design based on many different types of people solving many different types of problems versus from this perspective that is fairly insular? And maybe you disagree with that statement entirely. That's fine, too. But sort of talk to me about your thoughts on that.
I can pick up some of that one. Yeah. I think it has to do because we're focusing way too much on the startup entrepreneurs, the guys who start the companies, and we have the Mark Zuckerberg stores and all that. These are all team efforts. I mean, these companies, they're really successful. They have 50,000 employees after a while. And I work as a mentor for young girls who want to get into tech. And one of the really clever little advices I give them that they really like is that I tell them, why don't you let the guys go out there and do the startups because they're really into the risk-taking because most of them are going to fail? Because, if they do succeed, they're going to look around 6 months later or 12 months later and say, I need a product leader, I need a communication boss, and the girls are the best for that. And then you've got to be a tough girl and go into the room and say, I want half your company. So it's just like, to me, it's more of, if you look at the network dynamical picture instead of this constant focusation on stars. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea that the star is the guy who started the company, and because he started the company, he should be talked to and he should be the cover star or whatever. But that's not at all how any companies work, and certainly not how tech works. Tech is always a team effort, and it takes a lot of different talents for that, and to communicate the effort of the team to the outside world, which is what's something that women really excel at, especially women of color, then why not look into that instead? So give yourself a long-term strategy, build your own network of people that you're going to do the career with. And increasingly as well, if you talk to the human resource departments at these tech companies, they don't employ people any longer one by one. If you got a startup on your own that's a great team that just happens to work well together, they'd rather employ all 12 of you in that team and take you all in because that team already works and has the chemistry. And it's so damn hard to build chemistry between 12 people who don't know each other. So they don't no longer employ people one by one the way they used to at the H&R departments any longer. So if you build your team and you specialize on your specific gift, on your specific talent, and see your role, for example, as a product leader, multitasking person or something like that, you also take your own network, your social network, with you inside, so the companies will need that. If they're all white heterosexual men from San Francisco, they're going to die because they're going to communicate in the outside world, and not everybody is that, right? Mm-hmm. So take that experience, your social gram, and your team with you and walk inside the building, and you're going to do just fine.
Yeah, go ahead.
So... I wasn't quite sure. You started out with user experience and design thinking, right? Mm-hmm. It's a methodology for innovation. So I'm not sure if this is what you refer to as chicken and egg, but in the VC world, we have a saying when we're trying to evaluate, try to understand what is happening with trends, whether it's technology trends, market trends, which startups are going to succeed. We call it follow the money. Mm-hmm. So that's where the chicken and egg problem comes, right? If you say, well, we should be more mindful or empathetic with the disadvantaged Latinos, who don't even have a high school education. How are they my customers, mm-hmm. right? So it's a fundamental logic issue that if you're trying to build a business, you have to build your products or services for customers who are going to pay for it. Right? This is not a nonprofit. The principle behind design thinking is really very sound. It is the idea that whoever it is you serve, and this, of course, then applies to nonprofits, whoever it is that you are hoping to serve, you need to understand them. I mentioned this in another panel. Empathy is the key point here. It's not how brilliant you are, even your team. Of course, you need a great team. But it is really, do you understand who you are trying to serve, whether they can pay you or not? And that is really the real art of user experience design, not this other stuff, which is, my friends down the street on Palo Alto, I know what they like, I can build it for them. So many failures in Silicon Valley actually come from that flaw, that they all are just, they test their ideas, they test their prototypes in their very, very small, their own social network, that all think they're brilliant and they love what they do, but it doesn't play anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And this is just a fatal flaw in the way they think about building a business.
To Leo, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing that comes to mind, I remember reading an article when the iPhone came out, the unlock feature came out with your face. People of certain minorities couldn't get the phone to unlock because the iPhone didn't know how to read their face. Certain scanners for the wash basins in bathrooms didn't know how to start for anybody that wasn't white. That's a problem that I think the industry is starting to realize that is something that they have to solve. And I think that, you know, something that Paul, you brought up, that like once you get to a certain size, it's something that you can afford to do, but like necessarily, like if you're a very small startup, every single hire that you hire has to count. And I think that that's where we need to do better as society, to be able to represent different groups of backgrounds with the skill sets that they need to be able to be that valuable employee that somebody can hire and not feel twice, you know, any resentment towards, because that employer or that employee can do well for the employer, can bring value, and does bring another perspective. But especially once companies get to a certain size, I think they can start to afford to give opportunities to people who don't necessarily have that technical bar all the way to where they should be. But I think the reality is that's a cop-out. Everybody that's working there should be able to do it. It's not a handout. It's not a startup. And I think, again, it goes back to, yes, there's a problem. We're not equally representing the end users of all of our tools. But at the same time, as society, we need to do better to provide representative, competent employees that fall under all of those categories. And I'm not saying there isn't any or there isn't people out there trying to make this happen, but definitely this is something that we need to do better on.
Sorry. Just a small comment to that. Uber and PayPal are doing really well at the moment, probably the two fastest expanding companies in Silicon Valley. And Uber and PayPal are not run by their founders. They're run by a second generation of way more socially intelligent leaders than their founders were. So there's an example of that. We're maturing. That's basically what we're doing today.
Great. Okay, so we started the panel by talking about what the problem is. I heard some real themes about social networks and belonging, feeling like products are for you, feeling like technology is for you, feeling like you can see that in others in your community or others who are like you. I'm interested in this concept of belonging and inclusion in technology today in light of that. So where are there sort of sacred spaces of belonging on the internet or in technology? And to that point, where are there places where technology is really effective at building the connections across people? And I'm not talking about Facebook or social networks. I'm talking about real human connections. And maybe that's positing something you don't believe with. But you know, where is belonging happening in technology today?
Well, there's a bad word there that's actually quite interesting called a silo, right? We hear about silos all the time. People who get locked into their own silos, they only talk to people who share their own opinions, have the same background as they do, and then they hate everybody else, right? But that's to be expected in the beginning of a new medium. I mean, we settled in villages when we created the first permanent settlements 5,000 years ago, and we hated the neighbors, but at least we were safe in our own village. And we had to live in permanent settlements for 1,000 years before we started trading between them. So it's going to take a while, but I think silos are actually where you have to start from. Then the question is, how do you connect two silos with each other so you find overlapping space so they can communicate with each other? That's called narrative, and the machines will not do that for us. That is exactly why I'm a philosopher. This is the kind of work we do as philosophers today. The people that work in North America and California and New York are also working on narratives. How do you create stories that create a bridge between communities, where at least some people between two communities get connected with each other, and once they're connected, the other guys realize it's not scary any longer and they can start having a dialogue? And I think in America today, as polarized as America is, part of that has to be dealt with. There has to be neutral grounds for discussions in this country. They don't exist today. That's really, really dangerous. But also in the long run, technology, if we could do anything, would be to help us create these narratives that connect people with each other. This is the only way we solve the problem in the past. It's going to be the only way we can solve it now.
Great. Other thoughts?
Yeah, so there are a couple of ways that I want to chat about this. One is equating the concept of belonging with sharing common values, right? Which is kind of the same. So I think of this as kind of like the new tribalism. And this can be built around, so this is what aside from the larger social media giant type of activity, or even as a subset of that, really is building communities of common interest. And they're held together by the narratives that Alexander is speaking about. So there are some very admirable things. I think the nonprofit sector as a broad generality has really benefited a lot. And perhaps the most specific individualized version of that is a site called GoFundMe. So Alexander might say, hey, I want to do a book tour in New Zealand, and I'd like to raise $10,000 so to get there. And he could put up this campaign, and people would contribute money, and he would do it. And it would be a grant, basically. So, you know, in terms of raising money specifically as a resource, this works very well. And this is why, you know, many nonprofits are benefiting from this. But they don't know how to do it very well, honestly, because they don't understand how to craft the narrative in a compelling way. And this is a very common issue for entrepreneurs in general, because unfortunately they always start talking about me first, I did this, we did that. And unfortunately, that's not what anybody really wants to know. People want to know, what am I going to get from it? Like you talked about impact. Okay, what is the impact on my life? Why should I want to listen to you or to participate and support you? You haven't touched me at all. You're just putting up this big wall that has a flashing neon sign that says, look at me. Mm-hmm. So the last thing is really, unfortunately, because these tools are truly democratic in the sense that everyone can use them, we see the negative side. And this is not going to change. We have communities that are dedicated to violence or racism or any other thing that we consider socially less acceptable. And we are going to, as a society, we have to remember this is simply a reflection of our society. But the problem is their voices are amplified by the technology. And this is a new phenomenon. This is the key to the digital things that Alexander is talking about. We are not prepared for that. We don't understand that. The scale is terrifying. And what we have to do, of course, is talk about it and get people to understand and encourage more on the good side.
Great. Interesting point about social capital resulting in actual capital. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the thread that I see a lot is really empowerment of communities. And I think that, like, across the internet, there is so many different ways that is happening. But one of them that I think I'm going to drop a social network to kind of describe it, but I think one of the ways that we can do that is by sharing knowledge, not just like how Google opened the internet to the rest of us. I think websites like Quora, which are kind of question and answer websites that give people very specific information that they can then use to be empowered to create their own networks, to ask these people right next to me who they wouldn't normally have access to because they're one of the lost voices, if they so felt they wanted to answer one of the questions, they could. I think networks such as that empower people with information, and I think that for what is creating communities, like, first we have to just know what we're trying to build. I think that's all I could really add, but yeah.
Great. So I'll ask one more question, and then we'll go to a few more audience questions that we have. Respond to the statement, algorithms, harmful or hurtful to access?
I think the algorithm is definitely where the machine can help human beings. So one aspect of that is that marketing and advertising will be dead 10 years from now. The only reason it's not dead already is because marketing and advertising people still think it's live and that we care. Because you have a word for it, it's called spam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you let your algorithm be polluted by money, see, if you say you let marketing department sneak into your algorithm, it's called search optimization. It's the most evil thing ever invented. It's just organized massive lying. That's what search optimization is. I'm totally for the algorithm, but I also think that some of the startups in Europe right now said it's actually pretty easy right now to build a new search engine and start to compete with Google search. It could be a good time to do it because we need to have several available algorithms to us at all times so they compete with each other, because we need to keep the algorithms clean. Meaning, when I tap in a word in an algorithm, for example, I do want to know exactly who is the best in the world at this specific thing and who is accessible to me and who's within my budget. so I can access people that way. And algorithms are also be used for people to connect with people. We increasingly marry people we met through algorithms these days. Probably going towards society, we're going to marry 100% of marriages are going to be conducted through algorithms. Because algorithms are great at finding perfect partners for us. Much better than anything else was before, like nightclubs and stupid bars and getting drunk, right? So nightclubs are in a crisis, by the way. They've fallen 30% in the last 10 years because of Tinder and things like that, which is fine. So algorithms are great. And what I'm saying, and I said all week, is that if the machine, if we're going to ask the machines to do this one thing that is very, very hard for us human beings to do, is to go outside of our own in-group, go outside of our own silo, go outside of our own subculture, and start with these people out there not going to kill us, and loving the stranger. Loving the strangers for religion, for everything, has been the biggest issue for the past 10,000 years, and it's bigger now than ever, because now we're all interconnected. Everybody around the world is interconnected. And to avoid violence on a massive scale in the society, because also violent cults also have access to silos, they build their own subcultures. When they overlap, they start blowing bombs. So it's just reflecting human beings here, and if anything the machines can help us with is to build machines that make it easier for us to love the stranger.
Okay, you know, I think, I don't think I heard you on that panel, but it was a similar kind of a statement, and I was reminded of the book The Art of War by Sun Tzu, and one of his rules is keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer, which means really you have to understand them. You don't have to love them in that sense, but you certainly need to understand what they are. So you're referring specifically to search kinds of algorithms as limiting our capacity to define perhaps what's important. So the short term, well, first of all, an algorithm is simply a reflection of a pattern of thought. Right? And when it's driven commercially, that is one pattern of thought. And that may or may not be useful for your needs. It's designed for a very specific purpose, which is to move product as quickly as possible and most efficiently as possible, given the data that is presented. Now, short term, what that means for all of us, consumers, as it were, if we're not interested in the economic impact, is a lot more work. Right? We have to substitute, and this is very important, we have to substitute our own pattern of thought, translate that into a behavior, right? A series of actions that we will take. So we create our own search algorithm, totally inefficient, totally manual, totally dependent on what we, not only what we know, but what we are perceiving as we go down, right? So if I'm looking up some obscure person or some obscure topic, I will go through 10 pages of Google, right? I'm not going to stop with the first. In fact, I tend not to go to the first one first. I want to dig a little deeper. I want to understand what is around this unknown topic, so that I can hopefully begin to test myself on some of these other articles and references, and try to zero in on what it is I'm looking for. You know, if I have a very specific answer in mind, that's relatively trivial. But good research is you're trying to understand something you don't know, right? You're looking for knowledge you don't know. So you won't know it until you get there. And so you have to design, you know, your own pattern of thought and translate that into behavior. It's all manual. This is all human based on how you are interpreting narratives and values and all of that. So that's hard work in the short term. Hopefully in the long term, people will come up with a more automated, which is what we have now, search kind of capability. And there are people trying to do that, but it's very difficult to beat the money.
So I love what both of these perspectives has, but I kind of have a more fearful perspective on algorithms. And I'll say it like this. Algorithms that provide a service to us, Netflix recommendations, shopping suggestions, search engine recommendations. The thing about those algorithms, to me, that stick out, and to try to answer this question, yes or no, is something like that, if I get the wrong result, it's not going to impact my life significantly. I might watch something boring where I could have watched something that was really cool, or maybe I bought the wrong thing because everybody thought it was cheaper and loaded it up, and everybody else bought it because everybody else bought it, and then next thing I know, I bought the wrong thing when I should have bought something that cost $5 more and would have been way better. Those kind of things, I'm on board with. I don't mind those kind of algorithms. I would call those algorithms service algorithms. They're patterns of thought, as Bo said, that I can dig past the first results without any adverse consequences. The algorithms, to me, that worry me the most are the algorithms that make a healthcare decision about my future. suddenly it's not so real, because if somebody I don't know is looking at the algorithm and the algorithm says it's too expensive and the likelihood that this person is going to survive that surgery is X percentage, deny it, then I'm worried because I'm no longer being able to be represented as a human being, and now I'm automatically being judged as a number. So I would absolutely support algorithms in every single context where it isn't going to adversely affect and impact the human life. But I think that the impact on lives is actually a lot more commonplace and substantive than we realize. If you take a look at like what's going on in U.S. military, I believe the U.S. signed on to a treaty that says we're not going to put guns on any machines that can think for themselves. But that's not every country. And again, that's an algorithm that's deciding in the most efficient way how to do what it was trained to do. Same underlying problem, in my opinion. I think algorithms are going to save this world a lot of grief, provide us a lot of great opportunities, but there's a certain fine line where if it has an impact, I think we really need to be careful about it. And I don't mean like Elon Musk, how he thinks machines are going to take over the world. I just mean I better get that surgery if I need it. And just because I have a 7% chance of survivability, I want somebody to make that decision. I don't want a machine to make it for me. So.
Can I just ask one question to you about that? Because you work with prison, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, their track records are stuck forever in the digital realm, aren't they? So how do you deal with that when these guys who are going to put all this effort into programming and coding and work hard and get a job and go out there and do well? How do you deal with that when they come to you and say, well, my entire track record is now online and I can't eradicate it? Mm-hmm. How do you still motivate them when they come with that question? Because obviously that's true.
Okay. So two things. I mean, I'll answer that one, and I want to say one more thing, too. So if you're going to be, you know, that inmate that did or that criminal that did that crime, be that criminal that did that crime, and now he's standing in CWA. Or be that criminal that robbed a bank, and now he's a tenured law professor at Georgetown School of Law and practicing Supreme Court attorney named Sean Hopwood, who's not a bullshit story. Go watch it on 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. It'll pop up in search results. Thanks, algorithms. The thing I try to tell people is while we're not all going to be the outliers, it's really easy to tell people, you know, everybody, especially in tech, loves a comeback story. And a lot of people in tech have sunk big companies and hundreds of millions of dollars and got another investment from another VC to go start a new company. Maybe it was the wrong idea, maybe it was the wrong time. But the thing is people can appreciate other people's failures as long as they learn something. So yeah, while it's gonna be hard to sell somebody on the fact that you can program something when you just got out of prison for murder, which I have worked with many people who just got out of prison for murder and are gainfully employed right now. It is something that you have to explain to people that, one, across the board, you can't please everybody, but two, across the board, you can demonstrate why you should be given that opportunity, and you really need to, because it's fair to society, it's fair to your employer, and it's fair to you. You've done a lot of work. Talk about it. Process it. Tell others. The other part that brought up to me is actually with regards to algorithms and with regards to, you know, you've got this rap sheet. Like, for example, I can't remember what state it was. I think it was Pennsylvania. It could have been a different state. They are now implementing algorithms to give judges effectively a score for sentencing guidelines. Is this person likely going to get out and stay out? Is this person going to need a longer period of time? And the problem that I have with that is, can we trust the biases that were inherent or subconscious in the people who programmed the behavior in that judgment? Not only that, training data sets. Let's go back to the Apple example, because there wasn't people of all kinds of walks of life represented in the training sample. It didn't know how to read everybody's face, or in the sink. You know, if it wasn't a person that was white, it didn't know how to turn on. Most people in the United States are people of color that are incarcerated. So does that mean that the training biases are going to automatically suggest to judges that those people should go away? So that's why I kind of have a problem with algorithms in some contexts. But I think 100% without a doubt, if we take the algorithms out of those parts and allow a person to explain themselves, they're better off being able to speak for themselves and fail for themselves if that's what happened, than have a machine do it for them. And I think it's really fair. Like, we have to be able to tell people, like, it's not going to be easy. You just got to do it. And if you worked hard, great. And if you didn't, you know, I'm sorry, but you got to keep going. Don't give up. It's part of grit. It's part of life. You know, you will find somebody.
Yeah, I just want to quickly underscore, again, the importance of the narrative or the story. And one of the most important, one of the most appealing, universally appealing stories is, in fact, the hero's journey, right? A hero goes through, like Odysseus or any of these great tragedies where people do transform their lives. That's extremely touching. And yes, you have to do that. I mean, there's a lot you have to do to prove that and then to craft the story to be able to tell it effectively. That's the key, actually, for all of us. We are all on our own personal hero's journey, wherever we start from. And it's just it's a skill that we don't teach very well.
Perhaps the danger of an algorithm is that it doesn't necessarily consider the story at all. Maybe that's something to think about.
No, the point is the algorithm is a biased story. And
right.
Exactly the point.
So pivoting from that and to an audience question, how will deep technology evolve since the power structures that have built it have unconscious bias against diversity?
That's why I said it's a completely different set of talents to extract value out of data that's been collected than it is to actually collect the data. So you can build algorithms like Amazon does, for example, that recommends book depending on which books you bought before or what kind of books 58-year-old dirty old man like me buy. Okay, so that's what algorithms do. But they're sort of very clumsy algorithms, and it's just a very, very small part of the enormous value we can get out of data. So I would say it's a completely different skill set. And if you try to create deep tech that adds value to people's lives, and you're not interested in psychology, and you're not interested in that people are different, and you're not interested in reaching many different subcultures with different categories, different backgrounds, different stories, then you're going to fail. Because ultimately, it is the guy who, out of the deep tech, creates the most human value, they'll be the winner. The way I do this in Europe, for example, is I give a lot of lectures in Germany and France, and they're very late to the game. Okay, technology today is basically California and China. Very dominated by those two poles. So I just tell them that build 5G networks now quickly, catch up, you've done it before in history, and then focus on the one thing that I would give the most value to today is to say that anybody who studied both technology and art is probably going to be a good spot. If you studied both technology, art, history, and psychology, even better, because then you know human beings even better. And to know human beings is to know all kinds of human beings, all 8 billion of them. It's not just the select few. Because if you do that, if you understand human beings, you're going to be at the forefront of what deep tech is going to do. It has to do. Otherwise, it has no value to us, and it will fail.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, so again, just going back to the concept of algorithms being biased by the creators, and you know, whoever they are, however diverse they are, they still have their own limitations. So what you have to remember is the limitation exists here. The biases start here. And yes, you need to expose yourself, understand diversity, diverse topics, diverse peoples, all of this thing. But first, you have to expand your mind, right? You have to be open. You have to be curious. You have to be open. You have to challenge your assumptions constantly. And people who do this are the ones who will be successful as innovators, as entrepreneurs. And they are always around us. They're everywhere in the world. You know, there's temporary concentrations maybe in California and China, but that doesn't mean the rest of the world doesn't have a chance. They may be late, but they'll have to come up with something different if they're going to survive at all. And suddenly the world's population isn't going to shrink that dramatically, right? We're 7 billion and growing, and there's plenty of room for more creative energy.
Great. Tulio, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think I just agree 100% with what I'm hearing on both sides here. This mic is lower than all the other ones. So I think I agree with 100% with everybody else's, all these perspectives. We just got to do a better job. I'm just going to leave it at that and say that as a member of society, I'm really happy about what's possible, and I'm really excited about it, but I want to see more openness. Because as these things are evolving to provide value, I want to make sure that the data, I want to make sure that the quote-unquote value actually is representative of what I, as an individual, consider valuable. I'll give you one last example of that. I believe it's Facebook. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm one of those people that don't use it. Not that I don't use it because of all the Mark stuff. I value my time with connectedness and fulfillment. I do FaceTime. I understand now that they show you, and same thing with Google, supposedly, they show you why they recommended this particular story to you. And, you know, this is what I want to see more openness about, is as these algorithms are providing opportunities for us to be enriched, I want to understand why exactly did they believe in the first place that I am going to be enriched by this? Because I think that that's where we're going to start finding that maybe there's ethical lines that I don't like that's being collected in data about me. And that gives me an opportunity to at least be able to come back to the table and discuss if that I feel good about that or not. So.
Great.
Yeah, I want to make a quick observation. Seems that most of the questions have sort of a negative bias in the sense that they are asking about the negative repercussions, if you will, or ramifications. And that's perfectly valid. I'm not complaining about that. But it's very important that when you phrase questions with a negative bias, your mind isn't actually open. You may think you are because you say, I want to learn about this, which is good and correct. But we all need to learn how to ask questions that have less bias, increasingly less bias. And in that way, they don't have to be positive. I'm not saying that the antidote to negative is positive. I'm saying being open is different from being either negative or positive. And it's a new way in which we want to interact with the world and with each other.
Great. Thank you. So I'm going to introduce another audience question with a question that I had of my own. Maybe you've read this book, but maybe not, and I'll just tell you kind of one thesis. Thomas Friedman, in his book, Thank You for Being Late, posits that the Internet is very good at breaking down institutions and barriers, and is less good at building them. The audience member asked, with the ephemeral nature of social justice movements on the Internet, how can we use technology to create tangible change rather than letting these movements fade out?
Well, I was asked by Occupy Wall Street to join them when that happened. And I was one of very few speakers who turned it down and didn't want to get involved. And I remember Simon Critchlow and I had the same response. We both wrote, sorry, you are so proud that this is a decentralized movement and you don't have any leaders and you think it's going to work. You haven't studied history. Mm-hmm. Meaning it's going to be a T-shirt, an Instagram picture. You'll be gone in 3 days, go home, and the Wall Street guys will just laugh their heads off to you because you have no staying power. Okay, this naivety, a lot of infantile naivety that you just get some guys to like something and run off with it, then it's going to be valuable. And I think we're getting tired of signing documents that we have 60,000 signatures now, all press the button, that's all they did, right? And nothing will happen because people can actually ignore it. So I believe in a strong return of long term, a strong return to slowness. Simon Critchley calls it, this is not the time for revolution, this is a time for retraction. That means we're going to go back to monasteries, we're going to go back to being monks, nuns, it's called meditation centers here in Boulder. So you just go offline, you go somewhere, isolate yourself with people you learn to know online, this is what you do with your subcultures and physical space, and then you retract and you go deep and you go back and they realize, okay, this is what's valuable to me, this is what I'm going to clean out of my life, leave Facebook like I said, because just a Ponzi scheme, or use Facebook in a different way that's more meaningful to me. So we are going into dialectical reactions, and we're slowly growing up and maturing in our use of the Internet as it is today. As far as these social justice warrior movements are concerned, as long as they don't even pick up much crowdfunding from each other, they're probably really weak. Meaning, I think people who are based their political activism on some kind of infantile narcissism are going to fail in both camps. I think people who build the political activism long-term in creating strong subcultures that have reality, are reality-based, grounded in work, getting things done, raising capital, and creating a thriving community, they're the ones that are going to pay off in the long run. It's just going to take a while for us because we're going through this whole phase of children's diseases online today. So don't pay too much attention to what's going on today. Rather think ahead. What will human beings really require from the Internet 10 years from now? Because that's what's going to win in the long term.
Great. When I teach entrepreneurship courses, the first thing I talk about are the four characteristics that I think define what this journey is about. The first is seeking opportunities, looking for problems to solve. Second is taking initiative, you know, doing something. The third is being accountable, and I'm going to come back to that. And the fourth is delivering effective, practical outcomes. Now, yes, you can say, oh, that sounds like, you know, doing a startup. But actually, think a little deeper, and it is a description of leadership. Leadership in every context, for-profit, non-profit, government, education, any type of organizational structure. We are crying out for this type of individual, and we're not training them very well. So that's really important. Now, in terms of what you just mentioned, the problem with movements, exactly, is that there's sort of this passion. So it's a little like, oh, I have this great passion for this new technology. I'm going to build a startup. And then, you know, 6 months later, you get discouraged. Things didn't work out. Nobody wants to talk to you. And you say, oh, I'm going to give up. The problem when we talk about passions, we think about emotion, very spiky thing. The type of passion we're talking about here is that persistence, right, the drive, the determination that says, I realize I have to build something. It's not my emotion that's going to change the world. Yes, I might get 1 million followers in a month, but what's going to keep them together? What's going to motivate them to actually make some change? So there's a question, number one, there's a question of accountability. Then the prescription, of course, is you have to build an ecosystem. We've talked a lot about that. But I want to enlarge on one more point, which is, and I kind of mentioned that before, which is you have to break down the resistance first. It's not about pushing your own agenda and hoping that somehow that light will simply obscure all the dark corners. It doesn't happen. You have to understand, again, your enemies. You have to understand where the resistance to change is coming from. And you have to work with that. You can't just say, I'm going to defeat it with more money, more brain power, more tools, more algorithms. That's not the answer. You have to understand why that resistance to change exists today. And that will persist into the future unless you can do something about it. And this is the ecosystem that will help you do it.
Thank you.
So what I'm hearing you say is basically we have to approach building change as the same way of approach building a startup, in a way.
Of course.
Yeah. No, I agree. And it's funny because as I'm listening to this all, is like 100% as you're going through this, I'm realizing like that's exactly what we did when we were trying to change the narrative in prison systems with all kinds of unions that did not like that, with all kinds of social viewpoints that didn't necessarily think that that's what we should be doing in the first place. And, you know, I can't really add anything different other than to say, holy crap, that does work. And that is the way we have to approach it.
You're the living proof. That's the point.
Yay! I get to go home to not a cell. No, but realistically, I really love the way that you summarize it because I think, Alexander kind of really nailed it on the head, is we have to build something that we have to return to strongness, right? Mm. And it has to be something that's built for long term. And if we look at it like a company is definitely not built to last the next 3 months or the next few days. It's just too much effort. And as a product of a movement, damn, that shit worked. Okay, anyways.
That's perfect. Maybe we'll end there. Hard to say anything on top of that. Really appreciate your time today as audience members. Hopefully you found the perspectives of our panelists totally interesting and enriching, and really appreciate your time.
And thank you, Julia, for doing a great job. Thank you.